to the 4Jack Podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Season 5 of the 4Jack Podcast, powered by our friends over at Galvin Green. Galvin Green is the number one technical golf apparel brand preferred on every professional tour. They're famous for designing high-tech elevated golf apparel for every golfer, male or female, to feel invincible under every condition. Head over to galvingreen.com and get your apparel game dialed in for the 2023 season. This episode is going to be very exciting tonight, one full of learnings. But before we say hello to our special guests, we're going to head down to warmer climates and check in with the AGM, Mr. Derek Lane. What's happening in SoCal today?
Warmer, schmormer. I'm over it. 30 plus inches of rain in Southern California, drought relief. We can't use the word anymore, so we're good, right? Atmosphere. I mean, we are literally Vancouver. I mean, where you are, it's like I thought I was the one getting the break here, but you know what? I'm over this shit. It is just, it's nonstop. And so, hey, you know what? It's going to make for a good rest of the season. That's all. We are emerald green, which is just bizarro, right? So it's everywhere. We got another 2 inches today. So can't wait to get into this one, though. It's not very often we get OGs of things, right? Like we always have this one segment of a podcast, and when we get an OG of someone, we kind of have a different way going about it because you and I obviously love the game, but we don't know anything compared to what our guest is going to tell us tonight. So we know a little bit about it, but we don't know anything.
Yeah, honestly, this is huge for me because I've been wanting to dive into this, but just haven't dedicated the time. So without further ado, the 4Jack Podcast is extremely excited to host the man who's created the absolute cheat code for putting. This scientific process has been extremely effective. And if you've ever had doubts about your ability to read greens or make putts, we know that this episode will give you all the information you need to buy into all the hype that is Aimpoint Express. The mad scientist himself joins us tonight. Please welcome to the show, Mr. Mark Sweeney. You got him smiling out of the gate, so that's a good start. Mark,
yeah,
what's going on?
That was a great intro.
How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Busier and busier, especially springtime here.
Yeah, down in Florida, really busy, right? Everybody's trying to get tuned up.
Yeah. Everything's getting full blown between all the competitive tournaments. You know, the Florida Swing just got done. Masters is coming up. College is working their way into, divisional championships and national championships coming up pretty soon. So yeah, it's getting going.
That's awesome. This has really been quite the evolution of process for your vast audience of golfers, really on all levels. How exciting has this journey, adventure been for you?
Yeah, it's been crazy. I mean, if I look back, you know, I started this 20 years ago. I filed the patent for the Aimpoint software in 2003, which most people don't realize. And so I've been doing this 20 years and it's taken a lot of different evolutions. And I've had three or four different types of reads. And if you had told me even 10 years ago, you know, I'd be sitting half anywhere near I am right now with so many players using it, I would have laughed in your face probably. I've been like, yeah, no, yeah, I doubt it. Probably not. I mean, I knew it worked, but you know what I learned a long time ago is just because something works doesn't mean people are going to accept it.
Right.
And that takes time, especially in golf.
Not always willing to buy into the hype because people are scared of change sometimes, right? And if it's not really proven, some guys are using it, some guys are making it work. It's hard to digest sometimes, but overall, this whole sort of ecosystem of Aimpoint and this evolution has been pretty crazy process, like I mentioned, but maybe take us all the way back to the start. Take us to that day that you thought, hey man, there's got to be a better way to do this.
Yeah, that day happened when I was sitting on the couch watching the Open Championship in 2003, and I kept watching these players play at the, I think it was at St. Andrews, and they kept missing this 15-foot putt by a ton. They weren't even close. They're missing by a foot, foot and a half low. And I remember thinking, how are these guys who are pro golfers who have played this course a ton of times can't even sniff the hole on a 15 footer? It just made no sense to me whatsoever. And I had a background in software development. And so I just thought, hey, let me take a stab at this and see if I can figure out how to solve this. You know, and at the same time, the Mars rover was on, well, it just landed on Mars and was driving around taking pictures. And I kept thinking, if we can put a robot on the moon, on Mars, why can't we predict how a ball rolls across a slightly sloped golf piece of grass?
I guess that's a great starting point. So, like, I mean, you've talked about this a lot, and I'm sure it's kind of old hat, but what does a guy do at that point? Hey, how can I figure this out? Does he pull out a laptop? Is it a pen and a paper? What is that sort of starting point to this process?
Yeah, great question. The starting point is researching it and going and looking and saying, has anybody done this? Because I wasn't aware of it. So I researched a lot. I looked at a lot of technical papers. But the problem was, is people who had written papers, you know, the professors who had said, you know, how is a golf ball roll across a hypothetical surface that's a perfect parabola or a perfect, you know, perfectly shaped curve or whatever. They'd done some basic work, but none of it was real world. None of it had wind and grain and friction and, you know, a real golf green versus a hypothetical smooth surface. And so there really wasn't anything out there that seemed like it had been used practically. And so I started taking a crack at it and reading a ton of papers. And, you know, the first thing that I realized you had to have was a very accurate 3D model of a golf green, of the surface. Because if you can't model the golf green, then there's no way you can actually predict what the ball does. And the amazing thing was the first person I asked was my babysitter's father was in golf course construction. And I said, do you know anybody who can do really high quality, accurate topos of greens? And he goes, yeah, I met a guy 2 days ago. And he pulls out his card and hands it to me. And it was the only guy in the world in 2003 who laser scanned golf greens. And I literally, the first person I asked said, here's his card and hand it to me. And I worked with him for 10 years after that.
So this is like a perfect sort of connection of all the stars aligning. This guy.
Yeah. I mean, if that hadn't happened, I probably would have just given up at some point because GPS isn't accurate enough. Like it has to be a laser scan, but nobody had applied that to golf courses except this one guy. So it was a crazy, lucky, you know, fateful day that I asked the guy and he just handed me his card. So
Mark,
that kicked it off.
Yeah. And you have a background in software development and code writing and finance, I believe. So
yeah, and finance.
What possesses a guy to sort of take this risk and dive into something completely new?
Boredom. I was bored. I was working in finance in New York, and after 9/11, moved to Florida and quit my job. And I was literally, I think I had not been working for 3 or 4 months at that point. And I was just sitting. I was playing a lot of golf, and I literally had nothing else to do. And that allowed me to devote the time to dive into this kind of pet project, which you know, it took a lot of work in the beginning, but it was all up and running by, I'd say, within 6 months. It was done. It was built. It was working. The software worked. I take it out to the golf course and with my laptop and say, how much should this putt break? And then it would break the same amount. And I was like, cool, now what?
Well, and that's really where I'm interested in going. So obviously we found the backbone to the person that had the greens and we did the mapping. We've got all this stuff. Now let's take it into the hands of people. Literally, what was the process? Sorry, Chris, process. What was the process? Sorry, Canadian, a little humor there. What, from that point, how did we then get to the point where it was now truly in the hands of people reading greens and putters and start bringing that to the actual application of golf?
Well, that was a long process. So my very first application for the software was a Palm Pilot app that's actually on the front of my patent, if you look at it. And back in those days, if you remember, you know, an HP Palm Pilot didn't have any cell connectivity, didn't have Wi-Fi. You had to plug it into a cradle, which was plugged into your laptop or your PC. And it would actually, you know, bring up real golf greens and say, the pin is here and the ball's here. And where do I aim this putt? What's it do? And the problem was, is I built the app and I went on the golf course. And back in those days, you couldn't read a Palm Pilot in the sunlight. They didn't have sunlight readable screens. And so you'd walk out on the golf green, you go, I just can't read this thing. You know, the technology wasn't ready for it. And after testing it for a month or two, I just went, it sucks. You know, not that the software sucks, but it's not usable yet. And then I went, oh man, I don't know what to do. And my golf pro at the time said, oh, the TV networks would be really interested in this. You should do something for TV. So I made a couple calls, talked to a producer at CBS, and he connected me with a golf producer at CBS, and realized this was early 2004 now. So started talking to them. They said, go show us the PGA Tour. If they're like it, then we'll look at it again. So I took 6 months to get in front of the PGA Tour and do a demo. They said, yeah, we like it. And then it didn't actually get on air till 2007. So there was a 3-year gap between starting to show it to the networks and when the Golf Channel picked it up with a sponsor in at Kapalua in January of 2007. So there's a long gap there where I was doing live demonstrations. I was going to go into tournaments and kind of running it behind the scenes and letting them watch it in the background. But they either couldn't sell it or didn't sell it to a sponsor, or there was also a lot of pushback from the talent. There's a lot of the on-air guys going, this is just, you just can't do this. It's just not possible to predict break. And it took many, many years before they finally said, all right, let's give it a shot. Let's try it.
Well, what was that roadblock? What was the 3-year gap? Was it just trying to reconvince them and reassure them or share data, or what got the buy-in eventually?
It was a mix between not having buy-in, not having a lot of buy-in from the networks. And also the sales cycle for sponsorships for Golf TV is kind of in the fall where they lock in their budgets. And if you miss that, you're screwed. You're sitting around for another year if you miss that window, right? So first year I missed the window. The second year I missed the window. 4, 5, 6 missed it again. And it's in January, in November of, didn't miss it in six. In November of 2006, I started talking to Golf Channel because they got the rights to broadcast PGA Tour starting in 2007, which they didn't have before. And they wanted something new. And so it was perfect because this was a brand new graphic. Nobody had seen it. And they said, well, okay, we'll think about it. And I said at the time, I said, if they don't use this in next year, I'm done. I'm quitting. I'm out. Finished. Bye. Wasted 3 years of my life here. It works great, but nobody wants it. So I got to move on. And they said, okay, we'll use it for one tournament. We'll use it for Kapalua. And so we went to the Mercedes, we did it. And they're like, okay, now we'll use it for the Bob Hope. And then they said, okay, now we'll use it. I think we did six or eight. And then eventually it turned into a deal where we did 20 tournaments a year. But it was the most stressed I've ever been in my entire life during that whole time. That's no question about it.
That's a huge investment in time. I'm sure there's a monetary component to that, but like, Mark, he's ready to walk away from this thing. And now it's one of the biggest, best sort of proven tactics.
Oh, I was gone. I was fit. If they said no, thanks, I was putting it on the shelf and moving on. And then we get out to Kapalua, which is the single hardest golf tournament in the world to run an outdoor graphic because you've got wind and rain and mountains. And we show up the first day, we're ready to go, and there was terrible rain and the equipment went out from the rain. The batteries went bad and we actually didn't get on air the first day. And I ended up solving it by literally running 100-foot extension cord from one of the cameras into this old shed on the 15th green at Kapalua that we literally took baling wire and tied it on there so the plug wouldn't come out during the tournament. And that's what ran it for 3 days and got us the next tournament, which then turned into a six year long thing. But it was nuts back in the early days.
Okay. So we know the rig is popsicle sticks and duct tape, but let's talk about like the meat and potatoes of this thing. Let's talk about what is the tech? What is the IP behind this? What does that whole development process look like?
Yeah. Well, so part of it, you know, the 3D laser scans is a critical piece to it because you have to have a very accurate model of the green. And then there's a piece of code, that C++, that's about 110,000 lines of code, which takes the surface of the green, takes the starting position of the ball, the ending position, which you have to realize when you're solving a putt, you're not stopping the ball in the hole. You have to solve it to go through the hole at a certain speed so that it doesn't go any further than, let's say, a foot and a half past the hole, right? Then you've got to add in wind and grain. You got to get the stimp right. And if you get all the components right, it's spectacularly accurate. You know, and again, the problem at Kapalua is now we have 30 miles an hour wind. And so it's wind direction and wind speed. I eventually ended up putting a wind meter on the tower. So I got real-time wind information back, but I didn't have that at Kapalua. So you're sitting there guessing. You're literally just guessing going, well, I think it's blowing 25 from this angle, plug it in and let's hope it's right.
And you're on national TV, just rolling the dice with this thing.
Yeah. And it's live. It's not pre-recorded. It's live. And if you screw up, it goes out there forever. And it is, you want to talk about sweating bullets, you know, the first couple, you know, if the first couple putts work, they work for the whole day, but the first couple putts where they go, okay, we're going to you live. I mean,
so stressful.
Just flop sweat. Just, holy shit.
Yeah, I mean, just dripping, going, oh God, please be right. Please be right.
God, that's like, wow, that's an undertaking. So like beforehand, are you out there mapping stuff out, or was this already done before tournament time, or how does that step sort of affect that process?
The mapping happens about a week or two before the tournament, and the laser scans are good for multiple years. Okay. I mean, they're good for 3, 4, 5 years. So I just have to get the laser scan data. There's a little bit of prep that goes on, and then you've got to calibrate the cameras, which was another company did that, because you have to know where the camera is in 3D space, kind of like a satellite. It's really satellite technology, the virtual graphics. It's really cool stuff. And then my real job during the tournament was getting the green speed right. So you've got to get the stimp right, otherwise the break's wrong, right? And so that was easy. I would just watch putts, and you'd plug in 11, and if it broke more, you plug in 11 and a half, and if it worked, then you're good. So you kind of reverse engineered the green speed, because you really can't go out there with a stimp meter and get it right. It's a lot harder to stimping is not nearly as accurate as people think. But watching the putt roll, if you know the slope, which we did, you can reverse engineer, you can back into what the stimp must be by how much the ball's breaking.
Interesting. Okay, there's a lot of things to digest right now for our audience. So
yeah,
we have this whole physical sort of equation going on. There's obviously some sort of algorithm that's calculating these components at the same time. Would that be a fair?
Yeah. It basically figures out how the ball breaks every hundredth of a second as the ball is rolling to the hole. So every hundredth of a second, it'll say it'll move this much and then this much and this much, and it has to piece all that together, and it has to do it in 3 seconds. So I've got to be able to take any putt on any golf course in the world with any conditions and solve it in 3 seconds, because the TV sometimes will cut to you 7 seconds before he hits the putt and say, okay, go. And you've got to hit the go button, and you need a lineup before he hits the putt. So it had to work. You know, I used to work at Hewlett Packard and in R&D, and the rule was first it has to work, and then it has to work fast. And the big thing about my stuff is it worked, but it had to work in 3 seconds.
That's just unbelievable pressure to be under, especially when you're and like, this is being done manually at the time, correct? Are you?
Yeah. I mean, I sit in a trailer with a couple other guys who insert the graphic, and we're plugging in the stimp, which usually holds up for half a day at least before you have to change it. But we're clicking on balls, we're making sure the line comes up right, and then we're getting it on air, usually within 15 seconds. Sometimes, like if a guy misses a putt and turns around and has a 7-footer coming back, you've got to immediately get that and produce it. Yeah, but we'd also have to do 100-footers, you know, which usually we know those are coming after they hit their approach shot, so we have a little more time to work with it, but not always. So, you know, for 3 hours, we'd sit there and just be buried in the screen trying to figure out, A, what players do they want to watch? Because you kind of learn what the players, the producers are going to follow. Back in those days, you know, they'd follow Mickelson regardless of what he was shooting, right? And then they'd follow the top three to seven guys. And then if there was just a good putt somewhere with a random player, then we'd actually tell them, oh, there's a really cool looking graphic. You might want to record this or put it on.
Interesting. So you guys are integrated into sort of what the coverage is showing us as viewers.
Right? Yeah. We would sit there and we'd actually talk directly to either the tape guys or the director himself.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. So this started out as something that's being done on the broadcast, and it's working. Now we have the buy-in from CBS. PGA Tour is interested. This is kind of cool. This is new. It's innovative, right? We're showing something different to the audience, which is what obviously people love to see. They want to see the bright, shiny new toy. So how does it go from the broadcast to, you know, translate it to something that we can use in our everyday game?
Well, you know, when you model as many hundreds of thousands or millions of putts as I have, you see patterns. And when you see that there's patterns, that means that it's predictable. And if it's predictable, then I can use it as a golfer. So the real skill is, How do I use it as a player on the golf course with no electronics, with no laser scans, with no anything? And that was a hard process. I mean, it took 7 to 8 years before Express even came out. Oh, wow. You know, but I started teaching fundamentals of green reading. You know, where do you get the most break? Roughly how much break do you get? Then I created a chart that would say if you're 15 feet across a 3% slope on stip 11, it breaks 14 inches. you know, and I had players who used that. Scott McCarron was the first player to use that and went to top 10 in putting immediately. Lydia Ko used it. Stacey Lewis used it. A number of other guys used the chart, but it was very technical. It was very technical. And so you'd only, there's only a small percentage of people who like the chart and use the chart. So I kind of hit a wall on how many people would actually be using it, including juniors and amateurs and college players or whoever. And then by necessity kind of moved on from that to what a total accidental discovery was the express read.
Well, Parksy, totally accidental. You and I spent a lot of time in the desert and I was aware that Scott was one of the first, but if we get into the question that I know you get a lot, and I was trying to do a little research on it, honestly, Mark, and I still don't know the answer, but can you talk to me about your unique understanding of grain? So as a golf professional and what we do, we've talked at length about this, obviously being for Chris and I were in the desert a long time. So everything went to India and we've heard this, and I grew up on POA versus bent and all of these different things, but I really want to get your perspective because it's an interesting read from what I was able to research, but talk to us a little bit about your thought process and how that enters into what it is we're doing.
Yeah, so grain is a adjustment to your standard read like wind would be. On basically on bent, I do nothing for grain. I really don't see an issue with grain on bent. Now there was one time when I had an issue with a newly sodded bent grass green where the grain direction was a little weird and it kind of held the putt up. But Bermuda, it's absolutely an issue. And so what people don't get correct about grain is grain tends to go downhill. Not always. It tends to go downhill, but it doesn't always go straight downhill. It'll go roughly downhill. So there's two main problems with grain when you're putting. And the big issue is when the grain is opposite the direction of the break. You have to reduce your number. Okay, it breaks less. Depending on the strength of the grain, if we're talking in aim point express terms, it's between 0.5% and 0.5%. So what that means, if you have a dead straight putt on Bermuda grass that reads 0.0% on a level, but you've got cross grain, it's going to break like between 0.5 and 1. So it's going to be from 10 feet, it's going to be edgy or outside the hole, depending on the strength of the grain. You can also have situations which really screws with people's heads where you have a soft right to left putt with cross grain and it turns into a soft left to right. It actually makes, so instead of going left, it'll go right. So typically under the hole, uphill putts, you get this wedge where the fall line is in one place and the grain line's in another place. And if you're inside that wedge, you've got a problem. Everything breaks less, or a breaking putt, or it breaks the wrong direction, or a straight putt becomes a breaking putt. You get outside that wedge, then everything kind of reverts to normal where you're just kind of playing different green speed. You know, downhill grain is effectively much faster than uphill grain. So there's an effective stim component. But what really screws the people's heads is a cross grain piece.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Being from Vancouver, you probably don't have as much experience with that.
No, I mean, well, I spent a lot of time down in the desert, but I mean,
okay,
bent down there, 8-4 bent down there, majority is what we played on, or bits and pieces of some hybrid stuff. But yeah, I grew up in Canada playing a lot of POA greens. And I mean,
right,
depending on the time of the day, the grain changes a lot. POA flowers later in the day.
POA's bumpy in the afternoon.
Yeah, yeah. And it gets bumpy. And obviously there's spike marks and footprints and that kind of shit that people like to complain about. But I got to revert.
Yeah, there's nothing you can do about that. So
yeah,
footprints, I mean, you can't do anything about it.
Just variables that affect play, rub of the green, I guess, as they would say. But I got to revert back, Mark, because you made mention about a chart. So was this like a green reading book? Was this just a physical like cheat sheet that people put in their pocket and took with them on a golf course, or what was the chart specific?
Yeah, the chart was what Aimpoint originally was. It was a flip chart that you put in your pocket that had a different page for every stimp. So it'd be stimp 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And then there'd be a circle, concentric circles, which would be 5, 10, 15, and 20 foot putts. And then all the angles off it. So 30, 60, 90. So like a clock face. So you basically figure out where you were putting to the hole on the chart. So if you were 20 feet below the hole, let's say a 5 o'clock putt, 20 feet on a 1% slope, it would break 2 inches and it would tell you in inches where to aim. Super accurate because it would adjust for uphill, downhill. So if you had a downhill putt, it would automatically calculate the difference in break based on the difference in speed. The hard part about it was sometimes it would say it's going to break, you know, 41 inches. And you'd be 20 feet out going, I don't know where 41 inches is.
How do you find that? Walk it off, I guess, or?
Well, knowing your 20 feet is the easy part, but knowing where 41 inches is when you're lining up your putt, that was, believe it or not, a hard part.
Yeah.
And a lot of people complain. They're like, yeah, I know the number's good because if I go out and put a tape measure down and hit it right there, it's perfect. But when I'm playing, I don't know where, 23 inches is. I don't know where people, it's hard to get it accurate to an inch or two, and you have to be accurate within 2 inches to make the putt.
Right.
So as great as it worked, and it certainly made people better green readers, but that was the biggest complaint is I still don't know what that number means.
Okay. So now we have a problem and you're a guy that's solved this problem. So what sort of was the focus now? How do we make this better? How do we refine this?
Well, we taught a ton of people the chart, but we had very few people who kept doing it long term. So McCarron was one of them. Fitzpatrick was one of them. There's a number, Lydia Ko used her for a long time, but we wouldn't get, people would learn and go, yeah, that's cool, but it takes too long to learn and too long to get good at. And so I kind of hit a wall, and I was trying to, from a business perspective, saying, this is going to go away at some point because we've kind of maxed out how many people we taught and we're not getting retention. We need to simplify this. But I kept thinking, I couldn't think of any way to simplify it. I was like, I just don't know how you can boil green reading down. You have to have slope. You have to have stimp. You have to have distance. You have to have, angle. Well, I was kind of wrong about that. So what happened was, is I had to go teach 7 and 8 year olds in a clinic in New Orleans at Rob Noel's place. And he goes, they haven't had angles in school yet. So you can't teach them angles. You need to think of something else. And I was teaching him, I was literally sitting on the airplane about to land. He's like, you got to think of something else. We have a 2-hour class. Good luck. See when you get here. And I was like, crap. Well, it turns out Rob Noel was a bow hunter, and there's a way you use your thumb in bow hunting to figure out how far your target is. So you can say, at 20 feet, my thumb covers a 10-foot high pole. And therefore if it's, if things here, then it's 40 feet away. So it's just, it's triangles, right? It's geometry of triangles. And so what we did is I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're gonna have the kids stand on their line, feel what the high side is, and put their thumb on the high side. And that just gets them aiming above the hole. Just gets them aiming on the high side. Because what do kids do? They aim straight at the hole and they miss low. They aim straight at the hole and miss low. And then eventually it goes in. And it actually works shockingly well because your thumb is about 1.5, which covers everything from 1 to 2. So your most of your standard putts inside 20 feet, it was actually really close. And it was very natural. And the kids would walk up and stand on it and be like, oh, cool, there, boom, hit it there. And it was a very natural, easy process, but it wasn't nearly enough break on bigger slopes, right? And so I'm like, oh, it's cool. We can just teach little kids this. And we called it the thumbs up read. And I showed it to a bunch of my instructors at my conference like a month later. And they all looked at me like I had 7 heads. They were like, what in the hell are you doing to us with this thing? Like, we go from this ultra technical chart to thumbs up, really, dude? And I'm like, just try it, whatever. And then we kind of brainstormed and we experimented with, using 1 finger per percent, and it actually works almost perfect. And so I went out one day with a guy about a month later, and we just said, let's just test this. Let's get all these different putts and let's compare it wasn't called Angle Point Express yet, but the finger read with the chart number. So the chart would say 10 feet across the two breaks 9 inches, and he would stand at 10 feet, hold up 2 fingers, and it would show 9 inches. I'm like, what the hell, right? So we did all these putts, and it was accurate to about 2 inches from 20 feet. And I couldn't figure out why. I'm just like, I just don't get this. So then we showed it to a bunch of mini tour players, and they were like, oh, we like this better. They had done original aim point, but they liked it better. And the crazy thing was they would read the putt wrong and still make the putt. Like, it was like they would get the wrong number, but it was such an athletic, natural kind of visual. You're just kind of aiming at a spot up there. You're not aiming at 41 inches. We actually saw the performance go up even with a quote, less accurate read. And that was a big moment for me to go, okay, something's going on psychologically here where they just perform better with this type of read. And I showed it to Brian Gay, and he used it at Kapalua in 2014 and shot the course record, not even doing it right. And I'm like, okay, we're onto something here.
Yeah, there we go.
It took me a while. Eventually I reverse engineered why it works, and I didn't understand why it worked then. Now I understand why it works. And it's just a shocking coincidence that the geometry of your arm and your fingers match a golf ball breaking on a golf ring.
So
I have no idea, but it does.
If Rob wasn't a bow hunter, we'd probably be in the garage with this box of Mark Sweeney's ideas, right? I mean, this thing may not have evolved to where it is today.
No, I would have said, how about, remember the good old days when we pull these charts out and now I'm doing whatever. I would have been probably not being golf right now.
You're the guy that had the sticks and was walking around looking for water too, right? I assume.
Yeah.
Some kind of process. Like there's gotta be a better way to this. There's gotta be a better way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's a little bit of science here now, obviously. And you're saying that even though the tour players or mini tour players or whoever it was sort of adopting this process, the dispersion was so much better that even what they're doing now, even poorly, is a lot better than just whatever organic sort of green reading process they had.
Yeah. I mean, what I've learned from working with really good putters over the years is that if you take a really good putter and just get them anywhere close, they just make the putt.
Right.
Like Lydia Ko, you get her anywhere within 2 or 3 inches and she just makes it. Like they have the ability to fill in the gap of, okay, it's right in here, kind of in this little 2-inch window, go for it, knock yourself out. And they've got enough experience or feel or whatever where they just make it work versus people who you could give them the perfect read all the time and they're missing the edge, missing on the edge. But good putters, you just get them close and they just make a ton of putts, you know, and this gets you really close, really fast. Like I said, the accuracy is kind of 1 inch at 10 feet, 2 inches at 20 feet, which is still inside the hole.
And it is speed like one of those elusive variables, because some guys like to hit it to the front edge and watch it fall in the front door, quote unquote. Some guys like to play it, you know, holing speed, a foot past, so to speak, or some guys just like to ram it, have that little bit of pop stroke and like to bang it off the back of the cup essentially. So where does that sort of factor into this?
Yeah, that was a big problem with the charts, believe it or not, because the chart was based on a foot past speed. And I get players like Poulter who'd say, well, I don't like hitting the foot past. I like hitting 3 feet by. And so it was really hard to back out the 3 feet by rather than the 1 foot by with the chart. So what's beautiful about the Express Read is everything speed related is managed with arm bend. So how much arm bend you have. So if you hit it firmer, you just push your arm a little bit forward. It squeezes your launch angle down a little bit. And if you want to drip it in high and dead weight, you give yourself a little more arm bend and it gives you a little higher line. And so the player can organically adjust his read based on his own speed, not the speed I give him. So if you watch the guys on tour, you'll see different levels of arm bend. Some are a little straighter, some are a little more bent. Well, that's the speed they're choosing to use.
Well, you know, as the golf professional in the group, that was where I was at. It's like, so USC is at our facility here in Los Angeles, and you have these kids who obviously are just monsters at what they do, but they all do it differently. And so yeah. I've thought Justin, you know, has done a great job with the female team, who I watch pretty closely with strokes gained and how they go about this, but big believers in the same thing, but again, all from different regions of the world, all with different grassing and all of this stuff. So the arm bend, that which you just explained, was the part to me that was always slightly elusive when we were trying to go through this from all the times that I've had members or people what we have taught. But like, it was really different because the greens now that we play are incredibly pure. They're pure distinction bent. We run between 12 and 14 most of the time. So it's a whole different kind of on the ground type feel. So been very, very helpful to us, but I really kind of like the perspective that you just dropped there about how we can kind of control different ways of doing it. So I think what people really kind of need to know about Express is that it's not just a singular way. While it is in theory, there are different variables that a lot of people don't seem to understand from that top.
Yeah, and the amount of arm bend you have, what I've also learned from working with really good players is you cannot tell them that you don't like their speed. You can't say, okay, sorry, Poulter, I don't like 3 feet by. You need to be slower. He'll just be like, screw you, pal. This is my speed. You can't take a high level pro golfer and tell them they need to hit different speeds unless they're kind of dripping it in at the front all the time. But most of the guys are not doing that. Right. So you have to adjust around their game. And the chart was much harder to do that. Express is really easy to do that because they say, what speed you like? And I say, it doesn't matter what speed I like. You can pick any speed you want. You as a player, depending on the conditions, depending on your aggressiveness for that particular putt, pick whatever speed you want. And Express is not giving you a number. It's giving you a spot that you can kind of zoom in and zoom out on a little bit and pick whatever you want, especially situational. You got an uphill 7-footer versus a downhill breaking snapping putt, you could have very different speed strategies on those. Well, you can make that adjustment very easy with Express. And that really blew the door open for us because it brought in a lot of tour players who wouldn't touch it before because they didn't like being restricted to one speed only.
Is there a point in time where you ever run out of fingers and you're, uh-oh, okay, I don't know what to do now, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, I played lots of 6s and 7s and 8s, which were still fine. I played a couple 15s,
You know, you don't get 15 very often, but I've had a few 15s before, but usually, you know, 90% of your putts are 1, 2, 3. I have pictures of Adam Scott and Lydia Ko doing eights where they've got both hands up and they're doing an eight. That's not that unusual, but you don't get much more than that on a golf green. You rarely usually max out about eight.
Okay. Well, Derek, you can probably attest to this because Derek's at Rolling Hills Golf Course in LA, and that place is sideways sometimes with the way the putts roll and the contours of the green. So I can imagine at some point you're going to have 10 fingers up there.
And it's been a big asset. You know, like a lot of our good players are fond of the system just because of that, right? It's especially where you can, it's not unusual to have 45, 50, 60 feet, 3-4 times around. Our surrounds are running above 10 and, you know, they're just almost as big as the green. So monstrous as David Kidd was, it was a great thing for us to be teaching from the beginning. And I give Devin Bonebrake a lot of credit because when he first started there, he was a big proponent of it. And then we kind of stayed with that thought process going forward. And it's done well in juniors. And the thing that I like that Mark touched on when he originally said the story about 7, it really is a learnable skill for almost any age when explained correctly. And then using your feet and then start using the thought process, it is picked up very quickly, which is when I love seeing everybody now that's been using it for 5, 6, 7, 8 years, especially their junior golfers moving into the college ranks or better players. Like they've got it down to a science, right? That's when it's fun for me.
Yeah, it's a very simple process, believe it or not. A lot of people don't do it correctly. Like even I watch tour players, PGA Tour on TV, and I'm going, eh, like, you know, like they're if you really understand it, there's very few people who really understand at a deep level exactly what we're doing. But even if you do it at a very basic level, it forces you to play an up break. It doesn't let you underread big breaking putts. You know, and when people first do it, and Derek, you probably have this experience. When you first do it, you look at these breaks and you're like, there's no way the ball breaks that much. That's right. The number one thing people say to me is there's no way. And I'm like, hit it. Trust me, it will break that much. And it always does. But it forces newer golfers or people who don't read greens well to play a lot more break than they would otherwise. And then they're hitting way better putts. Their speed gets better because they're not under reading it. Their leaves are closer. I mean, I don't even blink looking at 4, 5, 6 feet of break, even on a normal green. And most people are like, there's no way. It's like, yeah, yeah. I had tour players tell me, they're like, no way it breaks 9 inches. I'm like, yes, it will.
It is somebody, and you know better than any, the believability of it all, right? So like I'm a Minnesotan, was born and raised there, and Tim Herron was, it was him and Tom Lehman. Well, I remember, you know, Tim's won twice in Texas and twice in Florida and grew up on probably the best bent grass greens I've ever played in Wayzata. And you just have this thought process and you nailed it. It's like these guys and girls know exactly what they're doing. And when they're on, they're on. And if there's some sort of process like this that can even make that more of a cocksure thought process, a really true understanding and feeling confident, that's when you just, you know, the world is theirs, right? So I've always been very baffled with the ability for people who grew up in certain regions to go down and play other grasses and get it and make sense, you know. Or like Max Homa is a perfect example. If you put him on Poa, he just feels comfortable. It doesn't matter where it is or what he's doing, he's just going to play that differently. And then now you start talking about Aim Point Express and some of these other things. It has to be pretty gratifying to see you and a lot of what you've developed help other people become better, if not world-class players.
Yeah. I mean, there's loads of players. You know, the whole thing with Aim Point Express is it takes the read out of the picture. It's just like the read is a read. Once players trust that, what happens is they relax, they stop worrying about the read, and their speed gets dramatically better. And so there was, you know, a great example was Victor Hovland. We looked at him like 3 or 4 years ago, and his ball striking was spectacular, and his putting was okay at best. And I said to my business partner at the time, I said, if Hovland could putt, he would be number one in the world. And then like a year later, he picked up Aim Point. He wasn't even doing it right. He was doing a very kind of beginner version of it. And he won twice, just like boom, boom. And then he went top 10 in the world, boom, boom. You know what I mean? And so, and now he does a really nice version of it. But there's guys like him, Sam Burns, you know, started Aim Point and within a year was, you know, top 10 FedEx Cup. And I gave him a 30-minute lesson and he just raw fundamentals and boom, off to the races. But he's one of those guys, again, you just lower their margin of error. You take their margin of error and you squeeze it down to 1 or 2 inches and leave them alone. And then they just perform as athletes. And that's when they relax about putting and you can see him just getting them going, yeah, the read's good. I don't care. Just roll the ball. And that's ultimately what we're after with any player, is just get the read, be done with the read and just go roll the ball.
So the underlying Easter egg here is Aim Point's going to build confidence no matter what, because there's science that backs the data that tells you you're doing something, even though if you're not buying into it, the data is there to show you, yes, this is correct, provided you're doing it in the right sort of facet. But is there a difference between wanting to make a putt, Mark, and wanting to roll up a lag putt? Is there a different thought process for that, or is it all the same sort of metrics?
Yeah. There's a little, well, the thought, there's a different speed process. So, you know, 20 feet in, you really want the vast majority to pass the hole within two and a half feet. Cause you get 20 feet in, you're in birdie range. If you're a competitive golfer, you need to make a ton of mid-range putts to win, a ton. If you're a competitive golfer, you need to make a ton of putts in 4 to 6 feet for par saves. Right. And so, you know, the big thing with juniors and college players is they're lagging 15 footers. Right. They're dripping them up to the front edge. I'm like, okay, well, that's okay in college. But, you know, if you want to win on tour, you got to make 5-6 birdies around. You got to make 24 birdies to win. And you're not going to make 24 birdies leaving them short from 15 feet. Right. So I do a lot of speed training up to 20 feet where everything, you know, pretty much everything has got to be past the hole, but not anywhere past the hole. You know, for me, 2.5 feet's got a maximum. So you're not lipping out and you're not introducing a three putt. But as soon as you get out to 30 feet, it really becomes kind of a dead weight speed because you want the closest possible proximity, right? And so if you're going to hit dead weight speed, and for mathematical reasons, you've got to build an extra break on your lag putts, right? You need a little extra launch angle. So what would normally be a 2 from 30 feet, you're playing 2.5, even a 3 is safe because you're going to lag it in dead weight and maybe miss 6 inches high versus you get even a little bit low and the thing's running away from the hole. So what most people don't realize, and I just showed this 2 weeks ago to Tommy Fleetwood, if you overread a putt by a foot, it'll miss 6 inches on the high side. Let's say a 25 footer. If you underread it by a foot, it'll miss 3 to 4 feet on the low side. So the low side misses are 3 to 4 times your error, and the high side misses are a half your error. Because the low side misses gets low and just keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. You can go out on the golf course and prove this yourself anytime you want. Like, get a perfect read to play a foot high and a foot low, and there will be 5 feet of difference between where those two balls stop.
Interesting.
Huge difference. So strategically on a lag putt, you want to play the most possible break you can without puking on it, right? And then try to hit a dead weight, and that will give you really, really, really close proximity. And you just never, ever want to be low on a lag putt, ever.
Something to be said about missing it on the pro side or the amateur side then, right? I guess there's some sort of validity to that after all.
Yeah, for a lag putt, absolutely.
Interesting.
You know, for a birdie putt, theoretically, you should be kind of be 50-50 low and high. You know, not always low or not always high, but maybe equal distribution. But a lag putt, yeah, always max out your break. Like, so much break, you can't believe how much your break you're playing. And you'll see the results be dramatically closer than anything that you underread.
Interesting. That's good advice for a lot of our audience, for sure. Not a lot of tour players listening to this, but a lot of amateurs will be.
And don't you think, Parsi, that's kind of one of the reasons we were so excited for tonight, is the simple fact that there are ways to do this. And so you always hear the cliche, see your local PGA professional and all the other things, right? But with data comes success. And, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, where you're at, if you have the data and you are doing it well and you're keeping this kind of what I'm going to say, ability to make good decisions on the green a little bit more accessible to the way people think, it's got to be a productive way to go about it. And you can tell that at the highest of levels, when people at that level use something and get better, then, you know, normally that trickles down all the way through. So congrats on that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I got one more question for you, Mark, and I'll throw it to close out the show. You've been very gracious with your time. Thank you so much. It's really been eye-opening for me. Is slow play a factor with aim point? I mean, I'm sure there's some haters out there saying, oh, look at these guys, they're putting their fingers up, they're wasting time. But then there's the other side of the coin where there's guys walking around, laying down on the green, diving into bunkers. What's your thought on the slow play?
Yeah, so people brought slow play into aim point when we were using the charts, because the charts were a very technical read. And so people could be slow, and that was fair, but the charts went away 10 years ago. And if you take any player and put an express read side by side with a standard read, and by standard read, I mean, look behind the ball, look on the other side of the hole, look on the low side, go back, squat down, fix everything and go. I've got many, many, many examples where the express read is light years faster. Now, some people, which I don't like, because they do an express read and then they do their traditional read, so they're doubling up on the read, That to me is a no-go. Don't like seeing that. I would never advise anybody of that. But if you just do the express read like it's intended to be, it should be maximum 10, 15 seconds for a birdie putt and you're done. And you're not tramping all over the place and you're not squatting. And you know, I remember when Keegan Bradley got beat up for, you know, doing a 6-foot read and he missed it at Dell Match Play last year. And the next hole, whoever he was playing against had like a 7-footer, took him like 2 minutes to read and hit the 7-footer and nobody said a word about it. And I'm going, that took him 3 times longer than Bradley, and Bradley's the one getting grief for this. Are you serious?
Yeah.
You know, and now look at Keegan. He's top 5, I think top 10, at least FedEx Cup. He's won. He's, you know,
gonna run.
And he committed very heavily to aim point about a year and a half ago. He just said, I want to understand this deeply. And his putting stats have gone through the roof. So, you know, he's done the right thing by learning it and embedding it and getting good at it. So no, I don't buy it anymore. I got it in the old days, and then it kind of got that. It got a little bit of a reputation for that, and then it's just been hard for people to let go of it. But if you really go in time, and I put timers on players, you'd be shocked. It is absolutely faster than traditional. It just looks different, so it gets a bad rap sometimes.
Love it. Thanks for the commentary on that. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you know, and that's the same, because you know what, Parksy, slow players are slow, and fast players are fast, regardless of what they're using. They understand what they're doing, and some people, meticulous as it may be, and the other people are going to be fast paced and calculate the information to move forward. So I've seen both sides of it, and it is always a crutch, but those people are also people who are slow in the middle of the fairway and on the tee box as well. So that's been pretty much proven since we've been doing this. But last one for me, Mark, and the thing that I'm the most interested about, because I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but give us a couple of people that you think do it the best, people that might be recognized by a lot of the listeners and some of that. But if you're going to emulate someone using Aimpoint, and I know that that's going to be YouTubing and a lot of what you do, and hopefully see, you know, somebody who's certified, but name some of the guys and girls out there that really, really get it.
That really, really get it.
Somebody that you would want to teach.
Yeah. I mean, on the women's side, you've got Lydia Ko, used it almost since the day she turned pro. She's very good and very quick at it. Brittany Altomare's used it ever since college. Very good at it. Madeline Sagstrom, I teach right now. She's very, very, she understands at a very deep level. So if you watch those three, their process and what they're doing, a lot of people watch it, but they don't really understand what they're doing. Those three, I think, have a pretty deep understanding on the women's side. On the men's side, people that I've worked with, you know, most recently, let's see who I would put. Sam Burns does a nice job. Hovland does a nice job now, although I haven't worked with Hovland. Fleetwood does a nice job. Keegan Bradley, even though he has his own little mannerisms, his process is good.
Good work.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So what I mean by process is, where are they standing? Where are they facing? And what people don't get is, it's not, you're not standing there facing the hole. That is not what you're doing. And a lot of people get that wrong. That's going to lead to misreads. So it's not just where you're standing in the putt to get the right number. It's the direction your body is facing. If you understand that, then you get any point 100%, you're off to the races. Nobody has to talk to you anymore about it. But they do a good job. Justin Rose does a good job. There's some other guys that I haven't taught that do an okay job. Max Homa does it. I didn't teach him. He does some things I don't love, but he's been very successful with it. So you just leave it alone.
True enough. Yeah. Really, really.
You know, some of the good caddies, Scheffler's caddy, Ted Scott, does it. I taught him. So you see some caddies who do a good job, but it's harder to watch them sometimes.
That was my final question of the evening for you. What's the buy-in been like from the players and the caddies? Was there a lineup? Were they beating down your door, or was it like, I don't think we need this?
In the beginning, they were very resistant, and a lot of the caddies were outright belligerent to me. I tried to do a caddy school at one point in New Orleans in the off season, and I had caddies saying, like yelling at me, saying, we don't need this. We're tour caddies. This is a waste of time. This is black magic. And I was like, whoa, that's gone away now. I get, you know, ever since they banned the green books a year and a half ago, I got a lot of very good caddies come and see me in the off season because they're like, the books are gone. I need to learn this. So the caddies are great now. They're very open. They see a lot of players and caddies making a ton of money using it. And so sometimes the caddies come, sometimes the player sends them, sometimes the agent send them. You know, sometimes the agent will call and say, I need so-and-so's caddy to learn this. Can we set up a time? And so I get very nice, you know, respectful reception for Aimpoint now versus 10 years ago where I was like dodging bullets everywhere.
You're hanging the garlic over the door, hanging the.
Yeah. I had nights where I was just like, screw everybody. I can't deal with this anymore.
I love it. I love it. It's a competitive advantage at any facet. So obviously there's a benefit. It's backed by science. It's backed by data. So if you want to make more putts, Mark, where can people find out more information about the program or where to get instruction from a certified instructor?
Yeah, thanks. If you go to aimpointgolf.com, you can find certified instructors on there and clinics. So a lot of the people, when they hold clinics, you'll find them on there. There's about 300 around the world certified instructors. I do recommend finding a certified instructor because there's lots of people who think they know it and you're not going to get taught correctly. And I've had many, many people come to me who said, well, I've learned Aimpoint, and I start watching them and I'm just like, I don't know what you're doing. Like, I honestly don't know what you're doing. Or they'll say, I know Aimpoint, and they'll start talking me through it. And I'm like, nope, 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 nope. So if you want to cut your learning short, go to a certified instructor and learn it from them. Instagram, Aimpoint Golf. But if you're really looking for instruction, go to the website.
Awesome. Fantastic. Very, very gracious with your time tonight. Can't thank you enough. I think this is going to open some eyes, open some doors. Hopefully it's going to give people an opportunity to make more putts and better their game through innovation. So thanks for sharing your story with us tonight, Mark.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. A lot of fun. I appreciate you having me.
Have a great night. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks.
All right, Four Jack fam. I know we all want to get better at golf, but let's be honest. Most of us don't even have a clue where to start. Do you dive into that YouTube rabbit hole? Try and find one of these self-proclaimed golf influencers that promises to have a quick fix. There's always that fear of spending hundreds of dollars without even being sure you'll see results. What if there was a better option? An easier way to get the benefits on your own time? Well, we're going to let you in on a little secret. We're excited to introduce a new partnership to the 4Jack podcast family, Swing Tweaks app. Swing Tweaks is a stress-free, affordable, and more convenient way to get a lesson from a certified PGA professional. Yes, someone that has spent time learning the mechanics of the golf swing and actually knows what they're talking about. All you need to do is jump on the app and record your swing from a couple different angles. The app will help you through this. Tell us what you're struggling with, and then hit send. Honestly, it's that simple. Within 6 hours, you'll receive a full video lesson from a professional. I can't stress that part enough, a professional. They'll analyze your swing, review the potential pain points, and talk you through the solutions, providing professional advice and the correct drills to work through during your practice. You want to take the guesswork out of game improvement? Swing Tweaks is that solution. Do yourself a favor. Download today on the App Store. Use code 4JackPod, that's number 4JackPod, at sign up for your first swing tweak on us. Absolutely no strings attached. What have you got to lose? Aside from a few strokes, good luck.